must be taken for granted, because what's being described as the anti-Netanyahu cabinet of change is still not an accomplished fact. They say Netanyahu is not simply departing the scene without a fight for remaining in office. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
South Korea is hosting the P4G Seoul Summit on Climate Change, bringing together leaders from more than 60 countries. Held both offline and online, the meeting sought, quote, inclusive green recovery toward carbon neutrality. South Korean President Moon Jae-in pledged more international aid.
We will provide more assistance to developing countries to lay tailored green growth policies. Countries have their own stages of economic development, and thus they also differ on the dependence on coal power. Certainly more assistance is needed to transition into a low carbon economy.
Outside, critics point out that South Korea continues constructing and exporting coal-fired power plants, which generate the most CO2 emissions of all fossil fuels globally, about 30%. South Korea's pledge to end coal power financing. Climate change scientists agree that the COVID-19 pandemic and its lockdowns reduced human activity, which caused a reduction in CO2 emissions. But that reduction in climate-changing pollution will be short-lived as people drive back to work, factories reopen, and airlines resume their pre-pandemic flight schedules. As the forum took place, environmental activists marched to the venue, critical of the government's carbon record and a new green growth plan to cut down old growth forest to replant young carbon-absorbing trees.
The P4G summit talks about solidarity for green growth, but the climate crisis talks that count on growth are wrong from the start. The current climate crisis is the result of infinite growth for the nation and capital, for power and greed. Even if you put green in front of growth, that's just whitewashing the truth.
P4G Partnering for Green Growth and Global Goals links with the UN's 2030 Sustainable Development Goals, which focus on 17 international crises. Urgent action on climate change is number 13. Frank Smith, Seoul.
To work in Afghanistan as a journalist, one needs to be ready for facing horrifying scenarios. From being taken as hostage by the terrorist groups or powerful local commanders to becoming a victim of a blast. It was 4 years ago on May 31st that a massive bomb explosion killed or wounded over 600 individuals, mostly civilians. Among the victims was Habibullah Hussein Zadeh, Press TV's cameraman in Kabul.
4 years ago, during the holy month of Ramadan, a major Daesh bomb blast hit the green zone of Kabul. Habib was on his way to the office. Unfortunately, he was killed as he was close to the blast site. We found his dead body in a hospital 6 days later.
The death of Habib was not the first tragic incident for Press TV staff in Kabul. Prior to losing Habib, Press TV Bureau in Kabul had already lost Sayed Farhad Taqaddusi, another cameraman who lost his life after a rocket hit Press TV's office during a complex Taliban attack back in 2011. Sayed Mohsin Husseini remembers how all of his colleagues were shocked when a rocket hit their office in Kabul's heavily protected area.
It was in October 2011 when the Taliban launched a coordinated attack in the heavily protected area of Kabul. One of their rockets hit our office, and we lost our brave cameraman Sayed Farhad. We are committed to following the footsteps of our martyrs.
Let's not forget that the media groups in Afghanistan are facing many challenges, from the shortage of financial resources to security threats that have forced over 300 journalists and media staff to either quit their jobs or leave the country. Based on official figures, over 133 journalists and media workers in Afghanistan have been killed and many others have been wounded over the past 15 months. According to the 2021 World Press Freedom Index, released by Reporters Without Borders, Afghanistan is still considered one of the most dangerous countries for journalists and reporters around the world. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thank you.
In a rare move, Iran's oil ministry has delegated a major oil project to local companies with the aim to boost crude oil production, as U.S. sanctions still cast their shadows on the country's petroleum sector. Worth $1.3 billion, the development project aims to boost the output in the Azerbaijan oil field to 320,000 barrels per day, up from the existing 140,000 BPDs.
We're running our oil industry amid the U.S. sanctions that seek to destroy the strategic sector. We're not allowed to import a single oil pipe. This is why we have made the greatest achievements during this difficult period. We continue to develop our oil fields to increase our output. We have done it before and we will do it now.
Azadegan oil field is located in southwest Iran and is in the vicinity of Iraq-Iran border. Its in-place oil capacity is estimated to be around 33 billion barrels, but with the current pace, only 1.5 billion barrels are recoverable. In 2009, China's oil giant CNPC won a $2.5 billion deal with Iran's oil ministry to expedite the recovery rate in the oil field. But in 2014, Iran revoked the deal due to China's foot dragging in fulfilling the project. Local firms say the move to handle such a mega project domestically is unprecedented in the history of the oil industry in Iran. In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to 1.9 million barrels a day. As a result, Iran's exports have dropped to less than 1 million barrels per day, down from 2.5 million prior to the U.S.'s pullout from the nuclear deal. Now, the signing of these contracts is in line with plans to double oil production to 4.5 million barrels a day in the next year.
As U.S. oil embargoes are still haunting Iran's crude, Tehran is resorting to domestic firms to keep the strategic sector up and running. Given the vast oil reserves waiting to be tapped into in the Azadegan oil field, experts say the development of the key reservoir means a significant boost to Iran's oil production and a strong comeback to the global market. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Voices rising across the globe in condemnation of Israeli war crimes continue to be heard as Palestinians and their supporters throng the streets of D.C. Steady rain showers weren't enough to dampen the spirits of demonstrators who came from all over the U.S. and descended on the National Mall by the busload.
Came out here from San Francisco. This is how serious it is. We need sanctions for sure, 100% on Israel, because what are we, like, are we their dogs? We don't have to pay them nothing. We don't owe them nothing. All you guys are doing is paying to get kids bombed in Gaza. And this is not right. We don't support no genocide at the end of the day. Like, this is not right.
The protesters called on Israel to stop killing Palestinians and condemned it for adopting what they called apartheid policies. They also called for an end to Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories and demanded that the U.S. government stop funding the regime.
For the thousands gathered out here outside the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., for the National March for Palestine, it's simply not enough that the U.S. government end support for the Israelis. They want them to go a step further and introduce measures to sanction the illegitimate apartheid regime.
Protesters also demanded the U.S. government cease its campaign of harassment and allow lawyers with the International Criminal Court to carry out their investigations of Israeli war crimes unobstructed. They also called for an end to the impunity granted to the apartheid regime by major Western powers.
No country in the world was in violation of international law more than Israel. All of us have to change this. All of us have to tell the administration it is about time to remove Israel from Gaza and from Palestine.
Other speakers rejected attempts by corporate media to use the manufactured anti-Semitism crisis to undermine public support for the Palestinian cause.
The people of the Gaza Strip have the right not just to survive, they have the right to resist, just as Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto did.
Regardless of whether or not the Biden administration bends to the will of demonstrators, those battling for Palestinian liberation here in D.C. seem just as ready to resist Israeli aggression as their brothers and sisters in occupied Palestine. Wyatt Reed, Washington.
COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers say 1 million doses of the country's first homegrown vaccine have been produced, which will be delivered to the Ministry of Health. Speaking at the press conference, the managing director of COVID-1 Barakat Vaccine Research Group, Hassan Jalili, said production of the vaccine will increase to 3 million doses next month.
We have produced 1 million doses of COVID-1 Barakat vaccine and will be delivered to the health ministry, and its production will increase to 3 million doses next month. And with the launch of new production lines, the figure will increase to 18 million doses soon. Public vaccination with COVID-1 Barakat is going to start in mid-June after clinical results are confirmed by the Ministry of Health.
Officials in charge of developing COVID-1 Barakat vaccine said with the third phase of human trial of the vaccine being almost finished, the result shows E1's vaccine has effectiveness much higher than expectations and is ready for emergency use after being approved by the Health Ministry. COVID-1 Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020 and started to be mass-produced on March 29th. E1 is among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus, and now four companies are endeavoring to release their products by September and inoculate the whole population. The second Iranian coronavirus vaccine, Razi-Covpars, which started a clinical trial on February 27th, will be mass-produced in early August. E1 is also currently producing vaccines jointly with three countries of Cuba, Russia, and Australia. E1 started mass vaccination against COVID-19 with a Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine on February 9th. E1 says it will soon become one of the world's important manufacturers of the COVID-19 vaccine. COVID-1 Barakat vaccine developers are planning to get the approval of the World Health Organization for this Iranian vaccine so as to be listed as one of the safest vaccines for emergency use. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The U.S. has pledged to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan by September 11. The move will put an end to America's longest direct war in the country. The announcement of a troop withdrawal has urged some circles to discuss the consequences of the American military presence in Afghanistan over the past two decades. As they say, the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan has had adverse effects on the country on different political, economic, social, and military fronts.
When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, it said the American troops were there to build a country, establish a modern Afghanistan, bring poppy cultivation to zero, and uproot Al-Qaeda and terrorism. But now the U.S. says it does not care about such issues. Of course, it was a lie, and we know about that.
Critics of the U.S. policy in Afghanistan believe Washington's involvement in Afghan issues is not limited to its military presence. They say Washington has also created ethnic tensions among local Afghans. Under such circumstances, political elites in Afghanistan say, as Afghans have fully experienced the cost of foreign interference in their country over the past four decades, they need to first come together and make a united nation and then make a strong policy to deal with foreign players in line with Afghanistan's national interests.
The U.S. military presence in Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism has not only led to an increase in militancy, poverty, and drug abuse, but apart from its disruptive consequences, it has also resulted in America's longest war. Now, after several years of struggle and hardships inflicted upon Afghanistan and its people, Afghans are welcoming Washington's decision to withdraw its forces from the country by September 11. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib front and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia. That is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliatory attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Massive public outpouring in Peshawar, the regional capital of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Anger is boiling in Pakistan like elsewhere in the Muslim world over Israel's atrocities during the 11-day long conflict, which the United Nations said could amount to war crimes. Pakistanis are particularly furious over Israeli troops for desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem Al-Quds, Islam's third holiest site. Similar protests have also been held in major cities against Israel's plans to evict Palestinians from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem Al-Quds.
We have a very deep secret love for Palestine. It is a part of our belief system to live and die for Palestine. And that is why such a huge number of people have turned up in this protest.
The ongoing protests are mounting increasing pressure on Pakistani government to help Palestinian militarily to prevent another Israeli aggression.
Pakistan has backed Turkey's demand to set up an international protection mechanism to prevent Israel's aggression in future, although the scope and reach of such a mechanism have yet to be established. Analysts believe that some non-Arab countries can form a joint military coalition in not so distant future.
We want the government to support us. We will go to Palestine to defend our brothers. But if Israel fights with us, then we will hit back.
More mass anti-Israel protests are expected in the coming weeks and months as different opposition parties are planning demonstrations across Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
enabled fully automated port a year ago in Shenmen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations as an automated coal mine controlled by a 5G network. We're prepared for you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled U.S. is Chasing China's Tail on 5G. The article has been published by the Asia Times. According to China's industry leaders, the mainland's manufacturers have installed about 5,000 private fifth-generation networks and will add tens of thousands more this year as 5G broadband enables fourth industrial revolution applications. China already has 70% of the world's installed fifth-generation base stations and 80% of the world's 5G smartphone users. The global chip shortage and U.S. sanctions against Chinese telecommunications equipment firms such as Huawei and ZTE have slowed China's fifth-generation build-out to some extent, but fifth-generation infrastructure already covers all of China's major cities. According to industry sources, China will add between 500,000 to 800,000 new 5G base stations to the 792,000 in place at the end of February. 5G's impact on productivity as well as profitability will come from downstream applications, not the network build-out as such. One Chinese executive told Asia Times, "It doesn't make any sense for the West to pour billions of dollars into alternatives to China's fifth-generation technology," adding, "It's too little too late, and it focuses on the wrong areas. Trying to invent an alternative ecosystem isn't going to work. I would have expected the United States to say, let's transform industry, let's be more competitive. As I argued in my 2020 book, You Will Be Assimilated, China's Plan to Sinoform the World, fifth generation is the railroad of the 21st century. A carrier technology whose importance lies in the other technologies it makes possible. Every important railroad company founded in the 19th century went bankrupt, and the industry was unprofitable until Edward Henry Harriman, an American financier and railroad executive, reorganized the Union Pacific at the end of the century. But it launched America's industrial and agricultural revolutions. According to a semiconductor industrial executive, the speed of further fifth-generation build-out will depend in part on China's ability to manufacture chips with transistor gateways of 28 nanometers or less. Most observers believe that China has mastered 28 nanometer process node production and will be able to fabricate most of its own requirements by the end of 2021. Media attention has focused on the newest chips with gateways of 7 nanometers or even less, which power high-end smartphones, crypto mining workstations, and other high-powered devices. But the workhorse of semiconductor applications is the previous generation of chips in the 14 to 28 nanometer range, which will provide the bulk of the chip demand during the next 5 years, especially for wireless connectivity. In its drive for semiconductor self-sufficiency, China has concentrated on fabrication capacity and chip-making equipment in the 28-nanometer range. Shanghai Microelectronic Equipment will deliver the first Chinese-made lithography scanner using the deep ultraviolet DUV process in late 2021. Washington persuaded the Dutch government to stop the Netherlands firm ASML from selling China the extreme ultraviolet scanners required for 7-nanometer and smaller chip production. Only Taiwan and South Korea have the ability to make the narrower gateway chips. But China has been an important buyer of Dutch DUV machines and appears ready to deploy its own. Although U.S. carriers offer what they call fifth-generation service, the American version provides download speeds barely above the older generation 4G LTE broadband and around 60 megabits per second. The average speed in China is 5 times higher at over 300 megabits per second. Private networks support industrial robotics as well as smart logistics, including automation of major ports. A fifth-generation network supports the automation of the Shanghai port, which handles 44 million containers per year, compared to 8 million containers at America's largest facility in Long Beach, California, where more than 20 ships are waiting offshore to unload. China opened its first fifth-generation-enabled fully automated port a year ago in Xiamen, with automated cranes stacking containers on driverless trucks. Shanghai's Yangshan port began fully automated 24-hour operations in August of 2020. In late 2020, Shandong Energy Group began operations at an automated coal mine controlled by a fifth-generation network. Automated warehouses, autonomous vehicles, and drones promise to transform e-commerce, with firms like Alibaba and JD Logistics offering same or next-day delivery from computer-controlled storage facilities where packages are sorted and sent by drones or autonomous vehicles. JD Logistics' $3.2 billion initial public offering launched in Hong Kong recently, promising a new level of productivity and delivery. JD Logistics still depends on 200,000 delivery personnel, but its warehouse management makes Amazon look primitive. According to a 2020 report by the Capgemini Research Institute, by contrast, Western companies are still evaluating whether they should install private fifth-generation networks to support factory automation. Some German companies, including Audi and BASF, are testing private networks. In May of 2021, Ericsson installed a private network for Airbus, Europe's premier manufacturer of civilian aircraft, but the network will run on fourth generation until the fifth generation network is launched next year. In Silicon Valley, Hitachi and Ericsson have built a fifth generation research network. With few exceptions, Western investment in enterprise fifth generation networks is tentative and experimental, while China's factories, mines, and ports have put fifth generation into full operation. The critical difference between fifth generation and older broadband isn't speed, but rather carrying capacity and latency or speed of response. Industrial operations require near instant response time among machines controlled by the network, and fifth generation, which reduces response time by a factor of 10, opens up possibilities for industrial automation that formerly were unimaginable. In 2019, I interviewed Huawei Chief Technology Officer Paul Scanlon for my book on China. Scanlon told me the combination of machine learning and fifth generation will allow robots to talk to each other and work out production processes without the help of human engineers. Paul Scanlon told me, let's take robotics today. Fifth generation changes everything. Typically, 5G is spoken about in terms of download speed, but that's not the most important advantage. He added, for industrial processes, autonomous vehicles and other applications, the latency, the time it takes for one device to acquire and respond to a signal from another device, is more important. On a factory floor today, robot A does its instruction, passes the bit to robot B, and it's the same thing. Paul Scanlon added, now if we put very low latency inside each of the robots, and they can be robots from different manufacturers, and put them in a room and give them the rules like Go or like chess to enable them to connect in real time, milliseconds, lightning fast, then put a bit of plastic in view and say, I want you to make a plastic cup, the robots will organize themselves much better than we would have thought. Scanlon added, you're going to push the plastic flat. You're going to extrude it this way. You're going to finish it that way. That's the way we think, and that might be the first attempt of the robots, adding, then afterwards we can talk about cutting down the amount of wastage, or the time it takes to make these things, or other key performance indicators, and they will start to do things differently. Huawei's chief technology officer concluded by saying, what we saw when we did this in collaboration between robots from different manufacturers, ABB, Kawasaki, and others, connectivity allows you to move from very basic stuff to very sophisticated stuff.
Debate. Hello, everyone, and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host, Behrul Snyder. A painful reminder of the dark and shameful chapter of Canadian history, and also an unthinkable loss that was spoken about but never documented. Both allude to the discovery of a mass grave on Thursday containing the remains of the 215 children at the Kamloops Indian Residential School. This, many argue, reminds one of violence inflicted by residential schools and wounds carried by communities into the present time. There's also a long list of human rights violations across Canada, including thousands of missing Indigenous women and girls. Stay tuned for a debate on that issue.
Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. The North American country has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights in the international arena. However, mounting evidence on racism and discrimination against minorities, in particular Aboriginal people, proves the contrary. Last week, the remains of more than 200 children, some as young as 3 years old, were found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children in the province of British Columbia. The Kamloops School operated between 1890 and 1969 when the federal government took over operations from the Catholic Church and turned it into a day school until it was closed in 1978. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said the discovery was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter of Canada's history. Indigenous groups also demanded a nationwide search for mass graves at former residential school sites. Vigils were also held to commemorate the victims.
It's really a tragedy for having those priests and those nuns running those schools, raping and killing and murdering and abusing those indigenous children. And it really takes effect into all the younger generation, that intergenerational trauma.
When I heard about the 250 children who, you know, were discovered, their remains were discovered in a residential school mass graveyard, my heart was absolutely broken. I've been sort of in a grieving mode since.
Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 indigenous children were forced to attend these schools, which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate indigenous children into a white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking indigenous languages, and many experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 indigenous children are known to have died at residential schools, but efforts continue to try to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that the country committed cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Such a system is just the tip of the iceberg, since reports suggest thousands of indigenous women and girls have also been murdered or gone missing in Canada in the last 30 years. Irrespective of decades of structural and systematic discrimination against indigenous people, which have been denounced by prominent rights groups, Canada also grapples with some other serious human rights issues, including persistent exports of military equipment to countries with a record human rights violations. However, Canada has time and again blamed countries such as Iran, China, and Venezuela for violating human rights. For now, the discovery of bodies at the former boarding school has once again turned the spotlight on Canada's claim about being a human rights advocate.
Well, that was Mehdi Farma reporting there. Let me invite one of our guests to this debate. We'll have human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Good to have you with us, Daniel. A real dark chapter in the history of Canada and the crimes committed against the country's indigenous people. What was your reaction when you first learned about a children's mass grave?
Well, I mean, I share the feeling that it's heartbreaking, and I was horribly saddened by this, but sadly not surprised. I mean, as you mentioned, there were thousands, tens of thousands of indigenous children taken from their families and sent to these institutions during my lifetime. And, you know, when you do that sort of thing, when you separate children from their families and you isolate them, this sort of thing happens time and again. And sadly, and I was raised Catholic, by the way, sadly the Catholic Church has been as guilty or more guilty than anyone in systematically abusing children, not just indigenous children, but children throughout the world, including in Canada.
Okay, on the phone with us, we also have former editor with the Catholic New Times, Ted Schmidt, in Toronto. Ted, in 2015, a national commission said that the Ottawa government has committed cultural genocide by forcing some 150,000 Indigenous children to attend residential schools. Now, some consider the issue as collective pain and trauma for Indigenous communities in Canada. What's your take?
Well, my take is Catholics are not fundamentally the guilty entity here. This is a governmental program. This is nothing but a settler colonial program. And the church is brought in as Canadians to be part of it. It's no different than what has gone on historically in places like Australia and South Africa. So this is just a settler colonial problem. It's terrible. But religion is not the fundamental actor here. Religion is just acting as part of the state. And that's where we have to take a look at it. I mean, in our morning paper here, they got it right. It says, Ottawa is pressed to account. Ottawa, this is the problem. Mm-hmm. Our indigenous people are like indigenous people everywhere. They've been shoved to the margins of countries. They've been put into the worst land. Their drinking water is terrible. It's settler colonialism. And now, I'm a no doubt about it. But the church is not the fundamental actor here.
Okay.
It, they've done bad things, but that when Columbus landed, religion follows the flag. The flag comes first. And the flag here is the British Empire, who came to Canada, pushed First Nations people into areas that we call ghettos in some countries. And if we took a look at Israel, you push people into Gaza. Here we push people into reserves. There's the fundamental problem.
I see. Now, Daniel, for more than a century, authorities forcibly separated thousands of indigenous children from their families and made them attend residential schools that aimed to assimilate the children into white Canadian society. So what have been the ramifications of such practices?
Well, I agree that this is a genocidal project, and I don't think you have to qualify it as cultural genocide. It's just genocide. If you look at the Genocide Convention in 1948, it talks about a genocidal act. One genocidal act is transferring children from their parents forcibly because of their ethnicity or race. That's exactly what happened here. It's genocide, plain and simple. It happened in Canada. It happened in the United States. It happened throughout Latin America. And it is deplorable, and it keeps happening. Let's not forget there are still thousands of indigenous women who have been disappeared in Canada and have yet to be found.
That's true.
Trudeau promised he would do something about that upon being elected. He's done nothing. So this genocide continues.
Ted, as you know, residential schools were run by churches, as also you just mentioned, until 1996. They were rife with physical, mental, and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence, causing intergenerational trauma for Indigenous population across Canada. Now, what can heal this old wound?
Talking to me?
Yes, go ahead, Ted.
What can heal this wound? Well, it's not totally genocide, because First Nations are here. They're recovering, much like Palestinians. Yes, it's been a slow and incremental genocide, but it's not totally genocide. First Nations in Canada are being educated, not as widely as they should be, but it takes a long time to respond to cultural genocide. There's no doubt about it. But there has been a wonderful advances with our First Nations people. But they're still struggling. I mean, you just don't respond to this overnight. So we have a truth and reconciliation, but we still have poor water on our First Nations reserves. We've had First Nations poison in the north of Ontario. But it's not total genocide. It's been a slow, incremental genocide, as it has happened in Palestine as well.
Now, Daniel, what are the underlying reasons for this legacy of Canadian colonialism to persist to this date?
Well, I mean, because, as my colleague mentioned, Canada and the United States are settler colonial countries. They were founded on land where people already lived, indigenous people already lived. And so a big part of the project of both of these countries was to remove huge swaths of these peoples from their land. And if they didn't go quietly, they were killed. And that is genocide. Can I just, again, remind people, go look at the 1948 Genocide Convention. You don't have to destroy a people in their entirety for it to be genocide. The Genocide Convention makes it clear, in whole or in part, you are destroying them. This is genocide. It's not kind of genocide. It's not cultural genocide. It's genocide. And we have to call it as such, because that has a meaning. If a country engages in genocide, that triggers certain obligations upon the United Nations to act, and they should act, to protect these people, to get these people the basic necessities they need, and to protect them from these states that continue to carry out genocide against them.
Now let's take a look at a bigger picture of the issues. Ted, Canada has oftentimes appeared as defender of human rights and a vocal advocate for a pluralistic society that respects rights of immigrants and minorities, yet you still witness wide-ranging abuses against Indigenous people and confinement of immigration detainees in jails and you name it. Why is that?
Well, it still continues. There's no doubt about it. It's highly embarrassing to Canadians who pride ourselves on the rule of law, but we have a prime minister here who will not act on totally. He uses language, but he continues to support genocide here, but also continues not to do much about Palestinian rights. Our record there at the United Nations is very poor. So it's a long time. There's a lot of power that the state has that it hasn't totally come up with total answers. We've had truth and reconciliation. But this isn't changed overnight. Canadians are very embarrassed by this. It hurts our national reputation as the people who care, who people want to live next to and observe international laws. So we haven't totally lived up to our international commission here and international rights, and we haven't lived up to it in Palestine either. This is exactly what our guest is saying there. You're just part of a separate colonial project. Canada was working hand in hand with Great Britain, shoving people into reserves, stealing their land. We've done this. They did this in South Africa. They did this to Aborigines in Australia, and they're still reeling with high rates of incarceration, drunkenness, etc. But even in Australia, there's improvement, and in Canada, as I said, we've had many First Nations. They deserve incredible credit for surviving this. They're getting educated. We have outstanding lawyers, doctors, professional people, but it's a long-term project. Settler colonialism doesn't disappear in a day.
Daniel, there are also serious human rights issues relating to overseas operations of Canadian extractive companies, and also nonstop exports of military hardware to countries with records of human rights violations. So let's have your comment on that, and how much longer will this go on?
I mean, it's going to go on as long as the Canadian people and the United States citizens put up with it. I mean, this is our tax dollars at work. We are invading and destroying countries throughout the earth. This is not only a genocidal project, it's a nihilist project. We're destroying cultures, ancient antiquities. I just got back from Syria where I saw that happening very close up. The West is on a crusade against culture and against peoples throughout the world. And if it's going to end, it's going to be because the people living in those countries who have at least some say over their government say it's enough. Stop.
Ted, let me name a number of other issues Canada has been grappling with. We have violence against Indigenous women, immigration detention, solitary confinement, corporate accountability, religious freedom, and disability rights. They're also among some other issues. Now, how can a country with such a record blame others for rights violations?
We can't. It's as simple as that. I don't think the answer, particularly in the United States, if you take a look at the United States in terms of Palestine, that's where the power lies. Now, in Canada, we have a little more opportunity to deal with these issues. But as I said, it's a long term. The tremendous response here to these graves, it goes right across the country. People are very upset about it, but as I said, it's not going to go away overnight. We're going to have to press our government to do a better job. I mean, when you look, we can't even give First Nations people drinking water. We can't solve this problem just yet. We keep making promises, and so the pressure has to be kept on by the majority of Canadians who care a lot about our international reputation. But say, nothing gets solved overnight here.
Well, let me ask Daniel. Daniel, Ted is saying that these issues cannot disappear and be handled overnight. So how much time is needed for anybody, Trudeau or anybody else, in the future to address such issues in Canada?
Well, it's already been a long night, hasn't it? It's been centuries. It's been a night that's lasted for centuries. I think it has to be tackled immediately. The time is run out for excuses. I think a lot of resources could be put towards First Nations peoples, again, throughout North America, very quickly, if there was the political will to do so, to help these people not just survive, but thrive and to rebuild their cultures. I agree with my colleague that it's a miracle that these First Nation peoples are still alive, that they have survived. And they have done it on their own. But it's time that resources, real resources, are diverted from war and given to these people.
Okay. And Ted, one last question. What's your prescription for Canada to tackle such woes?
Well, my colleague's exactly right. We're on the cusp of spending $29 billion for airplanes. Now, that has to be diverted away from war and to get very serious about our First Nations. And I would think that we're doing not a bad job of making sure that First Nations have free education and housing, et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to take time. But I think the goodness of the Canadian people are demanding this. We have parliamentarians who are taking this seriously. But we have to put the pressure on the PM, who talks a very good game and comes across globally as a very progressive person. But when we can't give people drinking water yet on our reserves, there's something wrong. So, you know, I've got confidence that as a people, we're good people, but things move slowly. Pressure is the only answer.
Okay. Well, let me thank our guests. We had human rights lawyer Daniel Kovalik in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and also former editor of the Catholic New Times, Ted Schmidt in Toronto, on the phone with their comments and contribution.